note packet is available to download online if you want to do it. We don't need it for another 2 or 3 weeks, but if you have the person who plans ahead or wants to sneak it into the printer downstairs, don't do that. No. Act like I never told you that. No. Whatever it is, so you got advance notice. But you can also, I think it's available at the bookstore, should be available soon if you want to buy it there. The second is, remember in the first week we talked about biases, and I said when you pick your company, I'd like you to think about what you think you're going to find, whether you think the company is going to be cheap or expensive. I want to formalize that process. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a Google shared spreadsheet with the class list on the left, so I have the updated people registered in the class. And I'd like you to sometime over the rest of this week actually go in and fill in two things. One is the company you've chosen to value, which puts you on the spot now, right? Because you've been lying to me for the last 3 weeks saying you've picked a company. Now the rubber's going to meet the road. And second, I'd like you to tell me, as best as you can, whether you think you're going to find this company to be undervalued, cheap, fairly valued, or overvalued. Okay? And this is not about grades. I'm not going to check this against your final answer and say you got it wrong. This is really about putting biases on. Justin?
Is the purpose to not look at any information before you make that?
Or whatever information you already have. You can't blank your mind out, right? So in a sense, whatever you've looked at so far, that's fine. Just give me your bias based on that. Zubin?
Yeah, if it's a private business.
If it's a private business, it's going to be an issue. Just enter not up, because obviously you can't say buy, you know. I don't want to ask you to make value judgments. A good business, horrible business, you know, because if it's a family business, how the heck can you say it's a horrible business? Because that's very insulting. So if it's private, just put an NA. So I'll give you those four choices. And let's see if we can fill the entire spreadsheet out. I considered for a moment actually putting one point out of the 20 points for just doing this. But I think you're grown up enough that I don't have to hold points over your head to make you do it. It'll take you 2 minutes to do. So I'll put the Google Shared spreadsheet together. You put in the names of the companies and the biases. The other is, if you get a chance, I know you have lots of stuff on your plate. You know, somebody once described what happens in this class as trying to drink out of a hose, because I just throw stuff at you and there's so much stuff coming, and after a while you just throw up your hands and I don't care what he wants us to do. Hey. But if you do get a chance, take a look at the valuation of the week for this week. It's a valuation of Krispy Kreme, but it's really not the Krispy Kreme valuation that I want you to think about. It's about the fact that Krispy Kreme announced that they were going to increase their stock buyback from $80 million to $105 million. And buybacks, I think, are perhaps the most misunderstood action, misanalyzed action in corporate finance. And at both ends of the spectrum, there are people who think buybacks are always good news. Why? Because they believe in the dilution bogeyman. You see why, if you are worried about dilution, buybacks is great news for you? What do buybacks do? They reduce the number of shares, right? So the number of shares is all you care about. See, this is great news. And at the other end of the extreme, there are people, and the way I described this in my blog post, who think of buybacks as the equivalent of the Ebola virus for corporations. And this is going to destroy U.S. corporations. And I think both sides are missing completely missing the point. So I put a very, very long post. It's like an entire paper on my blog on buybacks, essentially looking at the data and giving a very simple mechanism for assessing the effect of a buyback on the two groups in a buyback, the people who tender their shares back and the people who don't. And one of the things I talk about is there's a value transfer that can happen. It's a very simple, intuitive idea, which is if you have a stock priced at 15 and you value that stock at 10 and the company does a buyback, even if it can do the buyback at the prevailing market price, you know what's going to happen, right? They're buying the stock back at a price $5 higher than the value. The people who tender their shares back will then get the $15. The people who don't have just paid those guys $5 in excess value to go away. So the question becomes, which side do you want to be on? And I hate people who whine after the fact. This is a group that says, it's so unfair. The buyback was at too high a price. Those people who sold back made all the money. To which my point is, who is holding a gun up to your head saying, don't tender your shares back? It is a choice that each of us has. And if you truly believe that companies are terrible at timing buybacks, they buy back shares at exactly the wrong time, your investment solution is very simple. Just sell the stock back in the tender offer. Be on the winning team. If you think there's a winning team here and you think it's always the guys who sell back, why the heck are you sitting on the losing team whining about the fact that you're in the losing team when you had a choice to join the other team? It's like being a Mets fan when you can be a Yankee fan, right? But that's a side swipe, you know. But that's the thing to remember in buybacks is it's a simple process if you keep it simple. If you put conspiracy theories on top of it, strange things are going to happen. So if you, I actually attached a spreadsheet to the Krispy Kreme to figure out who the winners and losers are in this transaction. Because I valued the stock at about $10.75. The stock price is 17. You can already see who the winners and losers in this buyback are going to be, right? Who's going to win in this buyback? The buyback price is going to be higher than 17 because you got to tender at a little bit of a premium. So if they're going to buy their shares back at 17.50, this is, in my view, a no-brainer. If you are a Krispy Kreme stockholder, line up right now for the tender. Tender your shares back. Move on. If you're one of those shareholders is going to become a long-suffering, long-term shareholder, it's your choice. So take a look at it because it's a very simple setup for assessing the effects of buybacks. So let's turn to the topic for today. Today we're going to talk about cash flows, and let's again set up the process. Let's start with earnings. All our cash flow measures start with some measure of accounting earnings. Net income, operating income, after tax, operating income, some measure of earnings, right? So you're valuing a company in October, maybe November, maybe December 7th. That's about as late as you can do it because it's due on December 8th. But let's say you're one of those people who procrastinates and procrastinates and procrastinates. You get to December 5th and you say, oh my God, I have to do the valuation now. Now you've got to pull up financial statements, right? And I'll give you some choices. You can use the earnings reported in the most recent 10K. Which, if you're at December 6th of 2014, is going to be what? If it's a calendar year, it's probably going to be about a year old, right? You can multiply the last quarter's, which is usually going to be what, third quarter numbers are going to have come out? You can multiply that by 4. Don't go there, right? What's the problem with doing that? There's going to be all kinds of calendar year effects. Even if there's no seasonality in revenues, companies do things in different quarters. Don't multiply one quarter by 4. You can add together the earnings over the last 4 quarters. That seems like a lot of work, right? Because it looks like you need four quarters, 4 different 10-Qs. Actually, all you need is one 10-K and one 10-Q. And here's why. When you get the third quarter's 10-Q, in addition to telling you what happened in the third quarter, they'll also give you what happened in the first 3 quarters of that year and the first 3 quarters of the previous year. The rest is pure math, right? You take the 2013 full 10-K, you subtract out the first 3 quarters of 2013, you add the first 3 quarters of 2014, you got your trailing 12-month numbers. All you need to do is set up a little Excel spreadsheet of all the numbers you want to update, set up 4 columns. Last 10K, first X months, 9 months, 6 months of 2013, first 9 months or 6 months of 2014, come up with that last column, which will be the first column minus the second column plus the third column. You've got the trailing 12-month numbers. That's actually going to be the tools webcast for this week, is just creating those trades. But you don't even have to watch it. You should get the math. It's not that complex. So the choice here should be to take the trailing 12-month numbers and working. The fourth is an alternative if you trust the analyst numbers, because sometimes by the time you get to December, you'll have projections for what the fourth quarter numbers are going to look like because you're halfway through the first, and there are people who give you projections. So if you want to take that and use that as 2014 full year numbers, I don't have a problem with that. Just remember, check that fourth quarter number to make sure that something outlandish is not happening. So always go with the most updated numbers. We'll talk about what to do if you cannot get full quarterly statements. Because there are parts of the world still where you can get the annual report, and you get pieces of quarterly numbers, revenues, operating income, but not full 10-Qs. And we'll also talk about what to do about the fact that some numbers don't get updated every quarter. I'll give you a couple of examples, and we'll talk about one today. Lease commitments. You find them in annual reports, you'll find them in 10-Ks, but you might not find them in 10-Qs. Options, employee options, you'll find them in 10-Ks annual reports, you might not find them in 10-Qs. So what do I do about those? We'll talk about that later today. But your job is to get the most updated number you can for every single input in your valuation. Your value company, as of the date, you're sitting there with the spreadsheet, not as of January 1st, 2014, because I really don't care what the value was as of January 1st of 2014, because what am I going to do with it? I can't go back in time and buy or sell a stock in time. It has to be as of right now. So that's the first thing we're going to talk about. I don't think we'll get to this today, but maybe we will. I'll give you the accounting definition of capital expenditure, at least as it was told to me in my very first accounting class. Capital expenditures in accounting are designed to measure investments you make in your long-term assets. That's what capital, as opposed to what operating expenses are expenses designed to create a benefit this year. Capital expenditures are designed to create benefits over the long term. So I'm going to list off some items. So keep that definition in mind. Don't get into the accounting mindset yet about what they call CapEx. Think about what the accounting first principle says CapEx should be. And I'm going to start listing items, and you tell me whether they fit into this CapEx definition. Building a manufacturing plant. Obviously, right? And if you look at accounting statements, this accountant says, well, that was obvious. What about R&D expenses? What company in its right mind does R&D expecting to get a benefit this year? You say, but the benefits might be uncertain. We'll come back to that. You think the benefits of building a manufacturing plant are certain? What if I'm HP building a manufacturing plant to produce more tablets? How long did that last one last? 3 weeks before they pulled it off? Uncertainty is not the dividing line. It's about whether you're doing it for long-term benefits or for this year. R&D expenses are obviously a CapEx. In fact, they should be super CapEx, given the fact that in companies like pharmaceuticals or sectors like the pharmaceuticals, you could be doing R&D today expecting or hoping to get a benefit 10, 15 years from now. What about advertising by a consumer product company? You see where I'm going with this? What's the biggest asset for Coca-Cola? Brand. How do you build a brand name? Not by building a factory and producing a brand. It's by at least some segment of the advertising is designed to kind of imprint that in your head. So you could argue that advertising expenses could, at least a portion of it, not every dollar, but some of it. How about recruiting and training expenses at a consulting firm or an investment bank? But now you kind of get the picture of where I'm going, right? If your biggest asset is human capital or patents, the way R&D treats those expenses right now is completely inconsistent with the way it treats expenses at a manufacturing company. We have two sets of rules now in accounting. One if you're a manufacturing company, one if you're a technology company, which effectively means that I cannot compare the earnings of a Microsoft with the earnings of a GE. Which also means that I cannot compare the P.E. ratios of these companies because accountants are following two sets of rules. You say, what choice do we have? We're going to talk about ways in which we can clean up after the accountants because they sure leave lots of messes around. Our job is to make sure that the definition of CapEx we use in valuation follows the first principles, not what the accounting definition is. So all of those items are technically CapEx. Some are easier to capitalize than others, and we'll talk about why. One final point. One of the numbers you need to get to a cash flow is a tax rate. Last session, when we talked about cost of debt, we also talked about a tax rate to get an after-tax cost of debt. The tax rate we said you should use for an after-tax cost of debt is a marginal tax rate. What's the definition of a marginal tax rate? Davian? It's what you pay in the last dollar of income, right? So it's coming from the tax code. It's going to be 35, 38, 40% of your U.S. company and U.S. income. That's the tax rate used for the cost of debt. And the reason is, somebody fill out the reason why we always use the marginal tax rate for the cost of debt. What's the reason? Anybody? It's the same, but the effect of tax... In fact, if you look at this question, I'm asking which tax rate tends to be higher, marginal or effective? What's the answer? Which number will tend to be higher? The effective tax rate is the tax rate you actually pay across your income. The marginal tax rate is the tax rate on the last dollar of income. Which is going to be higher? The marginal tax rate is going to be higher. In fact, I'll give you a preview of the numbers. The marginal tax rate in the U.S. is about 40%. The effective tax rate is only about 28 to 29%. So if I use the 28 or 29% of my cost of debt, I'd get a much higher cost of debt, right? So this is a question you're going to run into. Why are you using marginal tax rate? So what's the rationale? It's not just decisions. It's why are we multiplying the cost of debt by 1 minus the T? What is it that provides us that tax benefit from debt? Interest expense, right? How does interest expense work? You have income of $1 million. You have $100,000 in interest expenses. You subtract the $100,000 from the million. What do you report as taxable income? $900,000. Think of where you saved on taxes. On the last $100,000, not on the first, not in the middle. It's because interest expense saves you taxes at the margin that we use the marginal tax rate. So when you do cost of debt, we're going to use the marginal tax rate. When we come to cash flows, we're going to have to revisit this question. Because there we're looking at all of your earnings as a company, not just your marginal earnings, and we have to decide what tax rate to use. So that's another thing we will talk about as well. In fact, let's complete this story about marginal and effective tax rates. I told you the marginal tax rate in the U.S. was 40. The effective tax rate is about 28, 29. In fact, if you take the weighted average, it's closer to 25. Why is the effective tax rate for U.S. companies so much lower than the marginal tax rate? Yes? Tax breaks, see, but it depends on the tax break, right? Because the way the effective tax rate is computed is the tax, it goes to the accrual income statement. It's the taxes divided by the taxable income. So any tax break like depreciation that happens before you get to taxable income can't affect your effective tax rate because the taxable income will already be lower, right? So tax breaks in the conventional sense are already factored into the taxable income. So tax breaks are... It lowers the taxes collected, but it's not lowering the effective tax rate usually. It could be tax deferrals of some sort that happen between the taxable income and taxes. In other words, what you see on the tax books is not what you see on the accrual books, right? So when you open the 10K, what you see as income reported is not what they're reporting as income to the tax office. Is that legal? In the U.S., it is. Companies maintain two sets of books, a tax books and a reporting book. So there might be some deferred taxes happening. It could also be that they use straight-line depreciation in their reporting books and accelerated depreciation in their tax books. I think it's absurd that you're allowed to maintain two sets of books. It makes valuation much more difficult because the numbers you really like to see are the tax book numbers, not the... So one is this, these accounting tax deferral games. And because accountants have this need to tie up loose ends, when they play tax deferral games, they also have to give away the fact that they're playing the game. So what do you usually see on the balance sheet of these companies to reflect the fact that they're playing tax deferral games? You start to see deferred tax assets or deferred tax liabilities. A completely useless line item. Because it's not like you can go collect that asset or pay that liability when you go bankrupt. But it's the accountant saying, hey, you know what, I've been playing games with you and I want to tell you how big the game has been over my lifetime. So one is tax deferral. In the U.S., that accounts for about 2% of the difference. Out of the 15%, 2 to 3% comes from the tax deferral. You know where the other 13% is coming from? It's actually a huge story right now. Yes?
Foreign revenue?
It's coming from foreign income, right? And complete the story. Why would foreign income cause my effective tax rate to be lower than my marginal tax rate?
It's not being incorporated. It's not being taxed at the same U.S. tax rate.
In fact, the tax code requires that U.S. companies pay the same U.S. tax rate on the foreign income, which is one of the strange features of the U.S. tax code. In fact, let me step back. There are two ways you can tax multinationals. One is called the regional tax system, which is what 154 countries have adopted, which is if you're a UK company or a German company with Hong Kong earnings, you have to pay taxes at the Hong Kong corporate tax rate, but you're done because the income was in Hong Kong. The U.S. has a global tax system. It and five other countries. You know, you don't want to know the names of the other five. They're like Estonia, I think, is one. So it tells you the kinds of characters you're kind of hanging out with. Okay? The U.S. has a global tax system. And I'll describe the tax system to you. And you think like a corporation and tell me what you're going to do. And then I'm going to ask you about the follow-through because it's going to make a difference. The U.S. takes all of a multinational's income and says it's going to be taxed at the U.S. tax rate, but here's the catch. But only the money when the money comes back to the U.S. This is like living on the New Hampshire border. And you work in Massachusetts. And Massachusetts says, as long as you deposit your checks in New Hampshire and the money doesn't cross into Massachusetts, we won't. New Hampshire has no taxes. In Massachusetts, like 7% taxes. We won't tax you. So what are you going to do? The money is always going to stay on the New Hampshire side of the border, right? You're not stupid. So what do corporations do? They say, well, if you're going to tax us the extra 15, 20, 25% when the money comes back to the U.S., we won't bring it back. Of course, that money is now, you can't use it to pay dividends, you can't use it to buy, anything that happens with U.S., interest, you're now cut off. So you can't invest in the U.S., you can't pay dividends, you can't buy back stocks, so it's in a sense trapped cash. So if you heard the word trapped cash, this is what they're talking about. There's about a $2 trillion trapped cash balance at U.S. companies right now. Apple alone has $110 billion in trapped cash. So when Apple had to do that buyback 2 years ago, it's only like $25 billion. Guess what they did? They borrowed the money to do the buyback, which sounds incredible. You have $150 billion in cash. $110 billion of it is untouchable. It is an extraordinarily perverse consequence of an incredibly stupid law. Because effectively, this money is not good. And that's because you're a U.S. company, right? If you become a U.K. or a Canadian company, that cash will get untrapped. Now you see the next part of the story coming, right? You're AbbVie, you're a U.S. pharmaceutical company. You buy a U.K. pharmaceutical company, and you're roughly... And you remember, after a merger, you create a new company. You can decide whether you want to be a U.S. or a U.K. company. Which one are you going to pick? The minute you become a U.K. company, you're going to untrap the cash on... That's the inversion story. And of course, everybody's up in arms. Burger King inverting to Canada by buying Tim Hortons. Two terrible donut, one terrible food places combining. Oh no, the food will get even more terrible, I guess. But that's not the story. It's about inversion. They're going to become a Canadian company. So, and of course, yesterday the Treasury announced that it was going to have rules to stop this. This is like putting Band-Aids on not just a little wound, on a gash across your stomach. You know, blood is flowing out. I'll put a Band-Aid there. It'll stop everything. I'm open. My insides are falling out. You're putting a Band-Aid on top of it? There are two fixes to this law, and they're both obvious. They're both staring them in the face, but I'll give you the bad news. Neither is politically palatable right now. First, why is there a problem here? Because the U.S. marginal tax rate is so much higher than the marginal corporate tax rate in the rest of the world. The U.S. has the highest marginal corporate tax rate in the world. So that's the first problem, right? So if your tax rate is 40%, every other country that you're doing business in has a much lower tax rate. So one solution is to bring that tax rate down to 25%. your trapped cash problem will become smaller. The second is to switch from a global tax system to a regional tax system. But as a politician, can you imagine making either recommendation? I mean, if you have a populist running against you, you are sunk. You are a corporate stooge. I was accused, actually, when I put this trap cash thing, of being a corporate stooge. I said, if I'm a corporate stooge, I might as well collect the good stuff that comes from being a corporate stooge. And I put out an invitation to corporations, just send me, I'm a stooge. Send me some cash. No, nobody seems to send it to me. But it's. I think the most depressing part of this debate is you can see the common sense solution, but you also know that it's not going to come easily. You know what's going to cause it to come? Is when half of the S&P 500 is no longer in the U.S. Then you say, oh my God, the problem has become big. We have to do something. Or you'll get the other congressional response, which is to make the trap cash problem go away for a short period. What can you do? You can do a one-time. It's always called a one-time tax holiday. Just this one time. Bring the trap cash back and don't do it again. The company says, oh, sure, sure. We'll do exactly. That's exactly what we'll do. The trap cash comes back. And, of course, the problem comes back again. And 10 years later. And each time you do it, you're setting yourself up for the game to be replayed over and over again. So that was a diatribe about tax law that I didn't mean to go on. But no, it's part of that cash issue. So let's go back and start thinking about these issues. I think we're on page 104 of your lecture notes. Let's... So let's talk about estimating cash flows. So I'm going to go through a three-step process in talking about cash flows. I'm going to start off by talking about earnings. Okay? And those earnings can either be net income if I'm looking at cash flow or equity or operating income. So I'm going to start with that. What exactly should go in there? How do we correct for accounting mistakes? Second, I'm going to look at how much of those earnings are going to be put back into the business to create future growth, either as long-term investments or short-term investments. So collectively, what are you reinvesting back? And third, if it is a cash flow or equity, I'm also going to consider any other repayments, debt payments I have to make. So earnings, reinvestment, and cleaning up for cash flow or equity. So let's start with setting the table. There are three ways you can think about cash flows. If you're lazy or intimidated by accounting numbers, you can go with just dividends. Because then you're saying, you know what, this is too difficult. I don't know what the cash flows are. I'll just take whatever gets paid out. If you want to be a little more fancy, you can add back stock buybacks because increasingly cash flows are being returned as buybacks. If you want to compute how much the company could have paid in dividends, potential dividends, it's not that complicated. It's whatever cash is left over after you've met every conceivable need. You're saying like what? Like capital expenditures, working capital needs, principal repayments. So think like the owner of a business. You're basically writing check after check after check. And after you've written every check you need to write, you look at what's left in the till. That's your cash, right? That's potential dividend. I'm going to call it free cash flow equity. It sounds fancy, but it's whatever cash is left over after every need is met. And there's a variant of that, where instead of looking at the equity cash flow, you look at the collective cash flows you have available for both equity investors and lenders. There, so starting with net income, you start with operating income. You act like you pay taxes on the operating income. I'll come back and talk about what I mean by act like I pay taxes, because I know I pay taxes on taxable income, but I'm going to act like I pay taxes on operating income. Then I'm going to subtract out what I reinvest back in the business. You're saying, what about debt payments? Remember, you're looking at cash flows to both players, equity investors and lenders. Any cash flows to or from those players should not be part of your cash flow calculation. That's why we don't subtract our dividends, we don't subtract our principal payments, because this is the collective cash flow from which I make all those payments. Free cash flow to the firm, free cash flow to equity, or dividends. So let's start with the setup for the cash flow to the firm. I start with earnings before interest and taxes, and then my accounting friends, and actually I don't have very many accounting friends, my accounting acquaintances, tell me that I should be careful that earnings before interest and taxes and operating income are not the same. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, you can do all the dances you want between those two numbers, but to me, they're fundamentally measuring the same thing. So I start with that. So I'm climbing the income statement, and I act like I paid taxes on that operating income. So let me back up there. Normally, when you look at a company and how it pays taxes, you take your operating income, you subtract out interest expense, right? Before you compute your taxable income, you pay taxes on your taxable income. What am I asking you to do? I'm asking you to act like you don't have interest expenses, which effectively means I'm saying don't count the tax benefits from interest expenses when you do your cash flows. Sounds like a weird thing to say, right? Isn't it a real benefit that you get, you save on taxes when you pay interest? Why am I asking you to ignore those tax savings when you do your cash flows? They must show up somewhere in your valuation. So what's the only other piece in your valuation? You got in a discounted cash flow valuation, you got the CF, and you got the D. So I'm saying ignore the tax benefit in the CF, so it's got to show up in your discount rate. And how does it show up in your discount rate? What do I discount cash flows to the firm at? What discount rate? The cost of capital, right? What goes into a cost of capital? A cost of equity and a after-tax cost of debt. Do you see the rest of the story? The cost of capital already reflects the tax benefits of debt. If I count the tax savings from those interest expenses part of my cash flows, I'll be double counting the same tax benefit. The next discounted cash flow valuation you look at, take a look at the cash flows. You're going to be surprised how often people double count the tax savings from interest expenses by either using actual cash taxes paid or some variant thereof, because then your cash flows are going to be expanded by that amount. Then I'm going to subtract out what I invest in long-term assets. The reason I'm not saying CapEx minus depreciation was we've been programmed by accountants to think in their terms. So I wanted to think of this net number as what you're putting into long-term assets. And we're going to have a much more expansive definition than accountants do. And I'm also going to subtract what you invest in short-term assets, inventory, accounts receivable, that I'm going to measure as the change in working capital. What I'm left with is my free cash flow to the firm. So the rest of today's session, spilling over into the next session, is going to be about getting those numbers nailed down. So let's start with the earnings number. It comes from an income statement. I talked about updating that number using trailing 12-month numbers. Easy to do in the U.S., surprisingly, in a lot of emerging markets. You know where it's most difficult? Is in Europe. Much of Europe, the practice is you get full annual reports, but you get quarterly reports that give you pieces, bits and pieces. They're not full quarterly reports. They'll tell you the revenue, the operating income, the net income, and that's it. You're saying, what do I do in a market where I don't have full quarterly reports? Work with what you have. And this is a point I want to make in general about inputs into valuation. If you get caught up in being time consistent, you're saying, look, some of my numbers in January, some are in October, so I'm going to stay with the January numbers because they're all in January, you're going to be sunk. Take every input and say, what is the most updated number I can get for this? So for revenues, operating income, you might be able to get the most updated number through the trailing 9 months. For interest rates and equity risk premiums and betas, it should be updated even more because you can get it as of right now. For options and lease commitments, it might be updated through the end of December 31st. You're saying, this is a mess. They're all at different times. I think they're all consistent because here's the bottom line. They're the most updated numbers I can for every single input. That's what the market gets as well. So don't feel too worried about the fact that things come in at different points in time. You want to get the most updated numbers you can, which means that your valuation, and this is bad news if you do it today, will be dated by next week. My suggestion is take numbers like the market price and interest rates that update constantly and make them a separate input sheet. In fact, if you want to be really clever, you can link it up to Yahoo Finance or something so it feeds in Excel. You can actually link up to it. And then just copy those numbers in a spreadsheet. You'll impress a lot of people because they'll be looking at your valuation. The number will be changing as they watch it. So what's happening here? So that's a secret formula. I can't tell you what it is. But basically, all that's happening is the risk-free rate and the equity risk premium, the market price get updated. Your value get automated. So think about that. As you start, if you're building your own spreadsheets, think about those inputs that you think will be constantly updated. The numbers that will give you trouble, though, is I think you might get lucky, because if you wait till, I don't know, though, because the second quarter earnings, you have the numbers already. But sometime in November, you know what's going to happen, right? You're going to get a third quarter report in your company, and everything is going to change. There's no easy automatic update for that. So my suggestion is be ready for that November shock when it comes. Your value could change, but that's the nature of the market. So update numbers. Second, normalize those numbers. And I'll come back and talk a lot more about this. But what I mean by that is often in modeling, in Excel spreadsheets, you have a base number that you build off, right? Revenues, operating income, net income. And that base number usually comes from the most recent year. That's not a bad idea. You want the most updated numbers. But if you have a company like Vale, you take the trailing 12 months, the most recent 12 months, the numbers look awful. Company's revenues are down. Its operating income is suffering. Why? Vale gets 76% of its value from iron ore, right? Iron ore prices are down a lot from what they were 3 or 4 years ago. So the trailing 12-month numbers reflect the fact that your commodity prices are down. And if I make that my base year and I assume that that's what the world is going to look like from right now, forever from now on, Vale is going to look like a terrible investment. So with commodity companies and cyclical companies, you might want to look at those numbers and say, what would a more normal number look like? Sounds fancy, but you're going to look across time, look across cycles to make a judgment. And third, you got to clean up after the accountants. And that's what I want to talk about next, is those two items that accountants routinely miscategorize that make your accounting earnings number less dependable. One is, of course, what we talked about, R&D and other capital expenses that get classified as operating expenses. The other is an item we talked about a lot in the context of in corporate finance, which is lease commitments that you enter into are really debt and should be treated as such. So I'm going to start with the updating part. And the updating part, as I mentioned, is easy usually for companies where you can get the trailing 10K and the trailing 10Q. If you cannot do that, do the best you can. And if everything doesn't get updated, not a big deal. Make the most updated numbers. But let's talk about correcting accounting earnings. As I said, if you look at operating lease expenses, U.S. accounting and probably global accounting all over lets you treat it as an operating expense, which means that if you take a company like the Gap or Target or Walmart, you'll see a big line item for lease expenses as part of their cost of goods sold. But what are those lease expenses for? If you're Target and you show me a lease expense, it's because you're leasing a store, right? And that lease contract usually runs 10 to 12 years. We've agreed to pay $2 million a year every year for the next 12 years. It's a commitment. It's a contractual commitment. It's a tax-deductible contractual commitment. And it's a tax-deductible contractual commitment that if you don't meet, could get you into trouble. Tax-deductible contracts will get you into trouble. That sounds like debt to me. If you borrowed money and had any of those issues, I don't think there's anything to debate here. Lease commitments, no matter how the accountants categorize them, are always financial expenses and should be treated as such. I already gave you my rationale for why R&D and recruiting and training expenses and some advertising costs should be treated as capex. So what I'm going to do is take you through the process of converting lease commitments to debt, which should be familiar from corporate finance. But I also want to go through the process of converting R&D expenses from operating to capital expenses. So let's start with lease commitments. First, you're saying, when will this even be an issue? It obviously is a big issue across the market. In fact, you look across the market, 11% of all operating expenses are lease expenses. So out of every $100 in operating expenses across the market, $11 are lease expenses. So it's not a small item. And if you're doing retailing or restaurants, 35% of what you see as cost of goods sold could really be lease expenses. That's a big, big item that's going to throw off your earnings. So I want to go through the process of converting lease commitments to debt. And then I want to talk about why I care from the context of valuation. So here's the process for converting lease commitments to debt. First, I need a table of commitments. I need you to tell me what your contractual commitments are in the future. In other words, not just what the lease expense is this year, but what you've contracted to pay. U.S. companies are required to do that in detail. If you look at a footnote, every U.S. company, if it has lease commitments, it has to show you lease commitments in year 1, year 2, year 3, year 4, year 5, and then it'll give you a lump sum beyond year 5. We'll talk about what to do with it, but those lease commitments are given. European companies do something that pisses me off no end. Here's what they do. Years 1 and 2. Years 3 through 5. Why? You know what year 1 and year 2 are. Why lump them together? So I have to do stupid things like take year 1 and 2 and divide by 2. And put half in year 1 and half in year 2. And take years through 5 and divide by 3. And put in. I don't even know why they do this, but... And of course, there are some countries where the company will say, we have lease commitments, but we won't tell you what those commitments are. That's an accounting hole in the ground. We'll talk about what to do then. But if you have the lease commitments going forward, here's all you need to do to convert them to debt. What did I say? They were financial. They're like debt commitments, right? So how do you compute the market value of debt? We take the interest payments and the principal payments, and we discount them back at the pre-tax cost of debt today. Pre-tax, because we're looking at pre-tax payments. That's all I'm going to do. Is I'm going to take those lease commitments into the future, and I'm going to discount each one back using the pre-tax cost of debt for the company. So where do I get that? That's what we spent last session talking about, either from your rating or a synthetic rating or whatever you decide to do. Take that pre-tax cost of debt, discount the lease commitments back. What you get as a present value will be the debt value of leases. Put in your balance sheet as debt. You're going to create a problem for yourself, right? What's the problem you're going to create? Your balance sheet has to balance. It's an unpleasant requirement, but one that you have to meet. So you put in $500 million as debt, what do you have to do? You have to create a counter asset. And once you create an asset, what are you trained to do in accounting? In following periods? You've got to depreciate an asset. You're saying, this is a pain in the neck. But it's not one of your doing. You have to carry it to its logical consequence, which means you have to create the debt, you have to create an asset, you have to do depreciation, amortization, you have to restate the operating income, because the operating income you see right now is after lease expenses. So you're going to have to add back that lease expense, saying, I shouldn't have subtracted it out, and then subtract from it the depreciation you have had on the leased asset. In other words, you're saying, if I treated this as debt all the way through, what would my operating income have looked like? Do accountants actually do something like this for a certain category of lease expenses? If you have capital leases, this is exactly what accountants do. Of course, they do it in this opaque way. You have no idea what interest rate they use. They just put it in as debt. But this is exactly what they do. So that'll take care of leases. So let me take an example. There's been all this talk for the last decade about how both GAAP and international accounting rules are going to get rewritten to make lease commitments into debt. It's a question of time. It's basically everybody sees the train coming down the tracks. So a lot of retailers and restaurants and others with big lease commitments are worried. So about a decade ago, an old student of mine who works at the GAAP has been working there for a long time, called me and he said, can you come in and talk to our management about what will happen to the GAAP as a company if our lease commitments were treated as debt? I said, sure. So I went in and presented to them the consequences of capitalizing leases. And I have to tell you, even before I show you the numbers, that they went through various stages of delirium as I was presenting these numbers. Initially, they were extraordinarily happy about what I was doing, and then there was a big letdown at the end. So let me go through the process. What I'm going to do is I'm going to show you what the lease commitments for the GAAP look like. So they had about $1.97 billion in conventional debt. These were the lease commitments that they reported for the next 5 years, 899, 846, 738. So these are not expected lease payments. These are contractual commitments already entered into. And then they gave me a lump sum of $1,976 million or something in year 6. You have two choices with that lump sum. One is you can say, they didn't tell me what will happen after year 6. I'll put it all in year 6. Or you can make your best judgment on how many years of lease commitments are in that sixth year. And here's how I make that second judgment. I look at the average lease commitment over the first 5 years. In fact, my Excel spreadsheet is set up as follows. I take the lump sum in year six, I divide by the average over the first 5 years. And because I prefer to work with round numbers, I round it up to an integer. So let's say that your average lease commitment over the first 5 years was $500 million. The lump sum was $3.5 billion. I'm going to assume that's about 7 years of lease commitments in year six. You're saying, how do you know? I don't. I'm just making my best judgment. You can also take the year five lease commitment and say, you know, that's more reasonable and divide the year six by it. But somehow make a judgment. And then discount back at the pre-tax cost of debt, which in 2003 was 6% for the gap. What I get as a present value of lease commitments is about $4.4 billion. So basically, all I'm doing is discounting the lease commitments back at the pre-tax cost of debt. Everybody clear on why I'm using the pre-tax cost of debt? Because these are pre-tax lease commitments, right? It's just the rule of being consistent. So I have $4.4 billion in debt. Here's what my total debt outstanding will now look like for the gap if I bring that in. So 1.97 is that conventional debt. You add the 4.4 billion, my total debt for the gap is now close to 6.4 billion. So it's changing how much it looks like they've borrowed. And if I restate their operating income, their stated operating income was about 1.012 billion. I added back the operating lease expense, saying I shouldn't have subtracted out. So this is the current year's lease expense. And then subtracted out 4.4 billion divided by 7. You see, what are you doing? Remember what I said, that that's an asset that you create, a 4.4 billion that I want to depreciate? What's the easiest depreciation method to work with? Straight line. Don't go asking for trouble. I want to use some of, if you really feel that attached to some of the your digits or accelerate, do whatever you want. I prefer straight line. Then I need a life for the asset, right? Now, how I came up with a life? I looked at what my lease commitments look like, because I come up with about 7. So it's not rocket science. I take the 4.4 billion divided by 7, I end up with a depreciation for the year. My adjusted operating income for the gap is 1.36 billion. So think like a gap manager. At this stage, what have I told you? You owe a lot more money than I think you do. You made a lot more money than I thought you did. So you ready for the delirium? So here's how I started. I said, let me start with the good news. So there's my conventional accounting for the gap. There is my leases treated as debt. So the good news is, when I capitalize your leases, your operating income jumps from 1.0 billion to 1.36 billion. They say, this is good, this is good. We have more earnings? Yeah, I say, you have more earnings. You're much more profitable than I thought you were. Then I said, there's one little catch. On the balance sheet, you told me you're only about 1.97 billion in debt. That really gives you, I think you really have 6.4 billion. That made them a little troubled, but then I said, that's good news. You know why it's good news? Because when I do my cost of capital, I weight the equity by the proportion of equity and the debt by the proportion of debt. With the old approach, the cost of capital I ended up with was 7.31% because they had less debt. Now that I've brought in all this extra debt, the cost of capital dropped to 6.25%. At this stage, they were in full delirium. You see why? I'm giving them more earnings. I'm saying your cost of capital is lower. They said, this is wonderful. Bring it on. And I said, there's one final piece of this puzzle. When I capitalize leases and bring them as debt, it now becomes part of my invested capital. And one of the key numbers you ask in any company is, are you making a good return on that invested capital? With the old definition of debt, it looked like you were making 12.9% because I wasn't counting your biggest assets. In this case, those lease stores. Now that I've brought it in, your return on capital is 9.3%. At this stage, they were completely confused. They said, so what's the bottom line? You know what the bottom line is. Is our value going to go up or down when we do this? What's the answer to that? There are two effects here, right? One is you have higher earnings and a lower cost of capital. The other is you're making a lot lower return on capital on your investments. The question is, which effect is going to dominate? There's actually a very simple rule of thumb you can use to make that judgment. What can you look at? What was the spread they were earning over their cost of capital with the conventional accounting? They were earning 12.9% as opposed to 7.31%. That's a spread of about 5.59%, right? After I capitalize the leases, the spread they're earning is about 3.05%. They're earning a lower spread. It's not always going to give you a precise answer, but if the spread drops a lot, then your value is going to decrease. If the spread doesn't drop by very much, your value might increase. And I'll tell you the most deadly case, the companies that look great before you capitalize leases, but then after you capitalize leases, not only does their spread decrease, it changes sign. The return on capital actually becomes lower than the cost of capital. That's what found for Starbucks in 2007, at the peak of their glory, when they're opening stores pretty much everywhere. You computed the return on capital for Starbucks, you actually got a return on capital lower than the cost of capital. And while they were being celebrated on Wall Street for being this high growth company, my reaction was, you're growing, but you're growing really badly. And of course, they woke up in 2008 and realized, but my point is, if you go with conventional accounting, you can sometimes miss some really bad things happening under the surface. Yes?
Shouldn't all of this already be accounted for by the market? I mean, this is all like public information that's disclosed. Like,
maybe it is, maybe it's not. You're doing an intrinsic valuation, right? Maybe it is. In which case, what are you going to find? That your value is close to the price.
Right?
So whether it's accounted for the market is a different question. It's not going to change any of the numbers I use in my valuation. You could say that about anything in valuation, right? Growth, it's already... But in intrinsic valuation, you're saying, given what I know about the company, what value would I attach? Then you turn your attention to the market saying, maybe the market already knows this. In which case, what you're going to find is your estimate of value for the gap is actually close to the price. And all those analysts are saying, the gap is cheap, the gap is cheap, because they're going to come up with a higher value because they're staying with the conventional accounting numbers. So that might or might not be the case, and that's exactly why you want to incorporate into intrinsic valuations. What's the question you're asking? Is the market correctly incorporating what these companies have truly borrowed? Right. I'll tell you the more troubling case. What if the market is not incorporating these numbers? What if the market is caught up in the hype that analysts are feeding from conventional accounting? That's when I think you face a conundrum. Because then your value is going to come in lower than the price. You're going to tell me it's overvalued. Maybe I believe you enough to sell short on the company. But you see the danger here? Is unless the market wakes up to these lease commitments being large and dangerous, you could be losing money while being fundamentally right. So my worry is not that the market incorporates it, it's what to do if the market does not incorporate this. Because there's no easy and cashing mechanism for catching the market doing something irrational. So that's why we capitalize leases. It's not because we want to torture ourselves, it's because we want to get a better measure of what the company's making as a return on its capital and a better sense of whether it's earning more than its cost of capital. I use this example in my corporate finance class, but I'll use it again. This is not just about leases, right? What is it that makes leases like debt? They're contractual commitments that you have to make in good times and bad times. They're tax deductible, and if you fail to make them, you're in trouble, right? Can you think of other contractual commitments that businesses might enter into that meet these characteristics?
Salary.
Salary, though, unless you go to a place like NYU where I get tenure and I get a guaranteed salary. Maybe universities are hugely levered because of it. But in most places, the reason it's not the equivalent is you get a salary, and they might say, I'll give you a higher salary, but they're not contractually bound unless they bind themselves. Any Barca fans here? No? You know, AC Barcelona? I was going to use baseball, but I decided to go with a global sport. I can see it's a horrible mistake. I was saying, who's Barca? What is he talking about, right? I mean, who did they sign? Neymar is who they signed? Do you know what his contract was? It's a lot of money for a lot of years, right? Yeah. It's like $20 million for 8 years. Or is it a contractual commitment? Yeah. It's tax deductible. And if you fail to make it, what happens? I don't know what will happen in European soccer, but in the U.S., actually, we know exactly what will happen. Manny Ramirez, for a short period, this is a scary thought, was part owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Did you know that? You know how that? Manny Ramirez is part owner of a baseball team that should scare the living. If you have no idea who Manny Ramirez is, go on Wikipedia, look it up, and it'll scare you as well. You know how he became part owner of the Dodgers? Because they had this big contract they signed him after they discovered, or maybe before they discovered, he had some drug issues. But the nature of Major League Baseball is you can sign these contracts and they're almost impossible to get out of. You think drug issue, that should nullify the contract? You'd think so. Any sensible person would think so, but in Major League Baseball, contracts seem to be written by non-sensible people. Which is part of the reason the Yankees still owe A-Rod, 3 years of $27.5 million, when there is almost no chance. Given how they're hitting, I'm hoping that there's some chance, but there's almost no chance. He's coming back and hitting 40 home runs next year. I don't even know whether he's coming back and hitting next year or whether he's coming back next year, but they're stuck with that. So if you're valuing the Yankees, what am I saying? You have to take those player contracts you entered into. The Tanaka contract for $160 million over 8 years is the equivalent of debt. So this is actually a bigger story than just looking at leases. Leases are easy because they're right there. But it's about any contractual commitment you enter into that's long-term that you're trapped into paying no matter what happens. Okay. Frank Quattrone, big-time investment banker at Credit Suisse. During the boom days, Credit Suisse actually signed a contract with him where they guaranteed income for him for like probably wanted to keep him there. But he had this contract, 5 years of guaranteed income no matter what happened. That's like signing A-Rod. Okay. So whenever you run into these contractual commitments, think about it. You've just borrowed money. Now let's talk about R&D expenses. Again, it varies widely across the market. It's small in some areas, but much larger in others. I was at L'Oreal on Monday. On Monday afternoon, I mentioned this before class, and they talked about their extensive R&D expenses. I said, what? What exactly are you R&Ding? But you see companies, even companies where you don't expect, there's some R&D, but the big R&D expenses are going to be at the pharmaceutical and the technology companies. Yes? They're supposed to, right? U.S. accounting actually requires that if you have a contractual commitment that you have to specify. I'll tell you the other place you're going to see this. If you look at Disney's 10-K, you'll see in the footnotes, broadcasting commitments. Know what those are? If ABC wins the bidding war for the next Olympics, they're actually required to make payments of $30 million a year every year for the next 6 years to the International Olympic Committee. So if you have contractual commitments, you're supposed to reveal it. Doesn't mean every company follows those rules. So if those are truly contractual commitments, they should be somewhere. They'd be hidden someplace, maybe. No, but that's the equivalent of debt again. Yeah.
How would you deal with something like that where it's not a certainty that?
There's a gray line. When I valued Disney, I chose not to treat those broadcasting commitments as debt because for most of them, maybe not for the Olympic contract, there are escape hatches. There are escape hatches that are built into the contracts, and often you don't know what those. So the operating lease is definitely debt. The other commitments, you might have to make a judgment company by company. Now let's talk about R&D. Big differences across companies. You look at a pharmaceutical company, you know, it could be 40% or 50% of your expenses are R&D. So the first question you have to address is why R&D is a capital expense. So let me play devil's advocate here. About two or three years ago, I was asked to give the keynote speech at the AICPA. It's actually a scary thought to be with 1,000 accountants in one room. I don't think they'll invite me back. But my presentation was about the 10 things I don't understand in accounting. I said, humor me, tell me why you do things this way. There must be a reason. And one of the items I brought up was this issue of R&D. Why do you treat R&D as an operating expense? And I showed them their own first principles about capital budgeting. And I said, hey, based on those first principles about benefits over many years, what is your rationale for treating R&D as an operating expense? So you play I was going to play the devil's advocate. You play the role of the accountants. I don't want to play that role. You can have that role. Tell me the arguments that accountants use for not capitalizing R&D. Yeah, sorry.
Well, isn't it if,
I'll come to that.
If your firm is sort of business itself, is R&D, so if you're sort of like a research and development firm.
You're dead. If your business is just spending on R&D, then you are sunk, right? But then again, it's still about, you have a lot of capital expenses. You hope they turn, I mean, ultimately you have to make money, right? So it's going to be about revenues ultimately. Somebody said taxes. Okay. And you see the rationale there? That actually didn't come up with the accountants, because I'll make a general statement. If you're doing something purely for tax purposes, never ever admit to it. Because if you do, the minute you do it, it's up there on the surface. Okay. It is true, you do get the full R&D expense as a tax deduction, whereas if you capitalize it, you might get only a portion. But you're going to see even that is not necessarily true, because what you do is you replace the R&D expense tax deduction with two other deductions. One is the depreciation on your R&D asset. So basically, there might be, it might even out. So, but there is that tax rationale. Okay, let me play devil's advocate now, since I like that role. What if I built a factory and decided to stagger the payments over many years? Would you let me treat it as an operating expense? Which is effectively what you do, right? You often borrow money and you stagger the payments.
But the amount paid out is to someone is a huge...
So if I build a really big factory, you will let me do it? You're going into quicksand now, right? So the fact that I pay it over time or that I do it every year is not enough, right? Because I could do that with factories, I could do it with mini factories, mega factories. Those two reasons actually did not come up. There's a classic reason accountants give, which you have to think like an accountant. But it's making their earnings look much lower, right? So often when you think about cosmetic effects, it's the bottom line in accounting is earnings, and you capitalize R&D, you usually have lower earnings rather than higher earnings, right? I mean, nobody really cares about the balance sheet anyway. It's really the accounting earnings, and from that perspective, accountants should be pushing to take R&D off the operating expense. Yes?
What about the R&D
there, we have the accounting 101 reason. The benefits are too uncertain. Sounds pretty compelling, right? So which my response is, what if I decided to build a factory in the Ukraine? Would you let me expense it? All kinds of things could happen to it next month. Or in Kazakhstan, Borat could come and burn it down tomorrow, right? I mean, there are all these... My point is, uncertainty is not the dividing line we use in any other capital expenses, but magically it pops to the surface when you talk about R&D. It shouldn't be the dividing line, because then I can give you lots of sectors where nothing should be capitalized. You're a technology company. You have no idea what next year will bring. Everything you do is uncertain, so maybe everything should be expensed. So that defense they gave, but it very quickly kind of dissipated. So then they fell back on the classic accounting defense, which is, we're just being conservative. That's accounting, right? Conservative. Conservative in what sense? By expensing R&D, we're reporting lower earnings. That's better, right? Now, we can debate whether that's better or worse. I want your actual earnings, not lower earnings, because you want to be really conservative. Why don't you just tell me your company is making no money every year? That's really conservative, but it doesn't help me. But here's the reason it's not even conservative. And this goes back to your point about the balance sheet. When you expense something, what do you show on the balance sheet? Nothing. When you expense R&D, you've taken your biggest asset off your balance sheet. You're saying, so what? Remember that return on invested capital, we look at companies and say, are you a good company or a bad company? When you're a company with a lot of R&D-like expenses, you're going to get these astronomically high returns on invested capital, not because you're making very much money, but because there's nothing in the denominator. I'll make a general statement. Do not trust the returns on capital you see computed for technology companies and pharmaceutical companies. They're complete and total lies. Because they're based on an invested capital that doesn't include their biggest asset. Which effectively means you have to capitalize R&D, and it's a three-step process. First step in the process, you need to give me a life for the R&D. How long do you think it will take, on average, between the time you do R&D and a commercial product emerges? Notice how I threw the on average. Well, you know why I threw the on average, right? Because some of your R&D might not pay off. Some might pay off in 8, some in 10, some in 4. Just give me an average. And if you're in a sector like pharmaceuticals, the answer to that might be 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. If you're in technology, it might be 2 or 3 years. Second step, give me your R&D expenses each year for that life. So if you tell me there's a 10-year life, give me your R&D expense from last year, 2 years ago. You're saying, why do you need the R&D expenses from the previous years? If I tell you R&D has a 10-year life and I plan to capitalize it, what's the logical next step? I'm going to take the R&D and I'm going to spread it out over 10 years, right? That's exactly what I'm going to do. And I'm going to keep track of two numbers. One is how much that amortization of R&D will be this year and how much is not amortized yet. So let's take an example. Let's take SAP, technology company, fairly long-term life for its technology. Oracle and SAP, it takes a fairly long time to get that new technology out there. I'm going to give them a 5-year amortizable life between the time they do R&D and a commercial product emerges. There are the R&D expenses each year for the last 5 years. So that is easy to get. Just go back in the income statement, pull those out. Take the R&D expense from 5 years ago. I'm writing it off in 5 installments. There's the last 1/5 being written off this year. It's gone. R&D from 4 years ago, I'm writing off 1/5. There's 1/5 left over. R&D from 3 years ago, I'm writing off 1/5. There's 2/5. So basically, I keep track of how much I'm writing off, how much is left over. See this last column? If I add up that last column, I get 903 million euros as what I would have written off as amortization this year if R&D had been capitalized all through. See the 2.914 billion? That is the R&D expense from previous years that I haven't written off yet that is now going to become part of my balance sheet as an asset. But again, balance sheets have to balance, right? So if I put 2.9 billion euros as an asset, something's got to change on the other side. There are only two items on the other side. There's debt and there's equity. So which one should I increase by 2.9 billion? It's the equity that's going to go up because it's coming out of after-tax earnings. My equity is going to pop up by 2.9 billion. My operating income is going to get restated because in a sense, I'm going to add back the 1.02 billion in R&D expense from this year and subtract out the amortization. So my operating income is going to be increasing by 117 million. Again, when you're in the details, you're saying, why are we doing this? So let me give you the big picture of how it's going to change the numbers. My operating income for SAP, if I don't capitalize R&D, is 1.285 billion after taxes. With taxes, it's going to be 1.402 billion. The tax benefit actually evens out because what you do essentially is You, because of the fact that your tax books are still going to allow you to deduct R&D, I'm not changing those books. I'm allowing you to keep the tax benefit. Because I'm capitalizing because I want to get a sense of this. I'm not the tax guy, thank God. So I give you the tax benefits of R&D. So your after-tax operating income increases by 117 million. That's the good news. As with leases, there's the rest of the story. My book equity is going to go up by 2.914 billion. My cost of capital is going to be unaffected. How come? Because what are the weights I use for cost of equity? Market value equity, market value debt. The market knows what you're doing. It doesn't care about the accounting treatment. My net capex is going to go from 2 million. It looks like SAP is investing nothing when I look at the conventional books. But now that I capitalize R&D, that's going to jump to 119 billion. So let me pause here. My after-tax operating income increases by 117 million. My net capex increases by 117 million. So what's going to happen to my free cash flow? It's not going to change. My capitalizing R&D is going to do nothing. You're still writing that check out. You see, why did we waste our time doing this if our cash flow is not going to change? Because what changes is that return on capital that I'm going to use. in deciding whether this company is a good company or a bad company. And that number is going to be very different when I capitalize R&D at these companies. And again, I might find that a company like Merck that looks okay on a traditional accounting return basis looks abysmal on an after-tax return when I've capitalized R&D. I'm going to actually take you through a valuation of Amgen later in this process where I'm going to do that. I'm going to value Amgen using the conventional accounting. Then I'm going to value Amgen capitalizing R&D. And I'm going to get a very different value per share. And I'm going to put my faith in the second value because I think it's a more realistic way of thinking about value. But again, I'll open the door as to what will happen in the market never comes around to your point of view. Because you could be sunk even though you're right about the treatment of R&D. But that's why we capitalize R&D. And again, expand the discussion. It's not just R&D. It could be advertising expenses at a consumer product company. The problem with doing that, and the reason I'm a little cautious with it, is when Coca-Cola advertises every year, it spends billions. Some of it is designed to get you to buy sodas this year, right? And some of it is designed to build a brand name. So I have to make judgments about how much is brand name and how much is not. So more difficult than R&D. The amortizable life could be huge for a company like Coca-Cola when it does, because brand name is such a long life. You could have a 25-year lagging period. But that's why we capitalize R&D. And we're not helping firms or hurting firms. In fact, some firms are helped by this. Some firms are hurt by this. Amgen's value per share goes up when you capitalize R&D. Merck's value per share goes down. And you can form your judgments about the efficiency of R&D at these two companies based on those numbers. But we're putting R&D on the same pedestal we make any other investment. Say, are you earning a sufficient return on this big investment you're making? There's nothing good about R&D just because it's called R&D. In fact, if you're a Merck stockholder, the best thing that could have happened to you 10 years ago is if Merck had disbanded their entire R&D department, sent them home and said, no more R&D here. Sounds brutal. But they've spent $100 billion. Think about that, $100 billion in R&D over the last decade, and have absolutely nothing to show their stockholders as a consequence. There's nothing good or bad about R&D. There's nothing good or bad about innovation. You're a commercial enterprise. You're not Bell Labs. You say, I did great research. Who cares? If it doesn't make you money, it doesn't count in this. And that's what we're doing with R&D, is bringing it onto the books and saying, are you making a sufficient return? Any questions? I'm sorry. Let's talk about getting the earnings cleaned up. Often as you look at your company's accounting numbers over time, you might see one-time charges, extraordinary charges show up. And there's nothing wrong with it. The true definition of an accounting extraordinary charge is it's an extraordinary charge. It's unusual. You know when you should get suspicious? Is when you see one-time charges show up 10 years in a row, at which point it becomes a 10-time charge. And you say, this isn't an extraordinary item. You're just playing accounting games with me. In fact, in the 1990s, companies got really good at playing this earnings game. And British analysts actually termed version of earnings called EBBS, and it's not what you think. Every company would report earnings before bad stuff. And then they say, there's a lot of bad stuff that happened this year. Our earnings before bad stuff look really good, $15 billion, but there was $16 billion worth of bad stuff. You can let it go 1 year, but 7 years of bad stuff happening every year, somebody's playing games. So here's what I'd suggest. When you print off the financials for your company, and that's one of the nice things about using a Bloomberg to print off 10 years, you can get it on one sheet so you don't have 10-10Ks to carry around. Take a look at the numbers across time. Look to see whether there are patterns to these extraordinary expenses. And if there is a pattern, build that into your operating expenses because it's just a game that they're playing. So it's, again, not rocket science, but it's something that comes from common sense, which is you don't want to be trapped into treating an expense that's an operating expense as a one-time expense. What about accounting fraud? You know what? This is, I'm sorry, Suma. Yeah, one time.
If we think that the latest quarter's earnings that we have don't follow the trend, does it make more sense to ignore it, or does it make sense at any point to consider the estimates of earnings?
Well, it depends on why it doesn't follow the trend. I'll give you a couple of examples. You're looking at Boeing. In last quarter, they had a strike, and the earnings fell off the map. Then it clearly is something you might say, that's a one-time thing, it's done. But let's say you're looking at a cyclical company. In last quarter, didn't follow the trend. It might not follow the trend because there is that cyclicality you want to bring in. So be very careful about throwing something out unless you're truly convinced that it's not going to happen in recurring points. It might not happen every year, but even if it happens once every 3 years or once every five, you've got to factor that in. In fact, let me use the one-time charge example to show that. If it's truly a one-time charge, you're going to ignore it, right? But if I told you that this company reports a this bad quarter happening once every 8 or 10 or 12 quarters, here's what I'd suggest you do. Take that loss. So in this case, for instance, if you have a one-time charge of $1 billion that shows up once every 5 years, that's like having a $200 million charge every period, right? Treat it as an expense in each year. So that's my response to you. If it's truly something unusual that happened in the last quarter, you can't find any evidence of something like this happening in prior quarters, then you can act like it, so you can compute the earnings before this expense. But as you scan the previous quarters, you see every 8th or 10th quarter, this kind of bad quarter gets reported. It might be that the company just bundles together these expenses and takes them once every 8 or 10 quarters. Okay. So just use common sense and looking across time to make that judgment. It's never safe to assume anything in valuation. And the reason is you have 41,000 companies. And often you have individual companies. Let's put it this way. It's safer to assume in some companies than others. Okay? In fact, that's very closely related to what the next point I'm going to make is, when can you trust accounting numbers in general? It's depending on the history of the company. I'll give you one classic. With accounting fraud, for instance, it's after the fact, everybody throws up, I never knew Enron was coming. You're right. It's unfair to blame an analyst for accounting fraud. But there might have been clues in the financial statements you could have used to make a judgment as to whether you trust the trailing 12-month number or whether there's something bad hidden. Let me give you a couple of things that seem to come out of at least the research on accounting malfeasance. A consistent difference between accrual earnings and cash earnings. In other words, a company keeps reporting great accrual earnings. You know where you get the accrual earnings you're going to get out of the income statement. Where do you get cash earnings? Go to the statement of cash flows. Look at that operating cash flows component. If your accrual earnings are constantly running ahead of your cash earnings, then something strange is going on. Look for items like SG&A. Because, you know, this is where companies hide really terrible things. And if that item keeps jumping up and down, again, companies are doing really strange things under the surface. Go to the SEC website and see how many times your company restates its accounting statements. Because every time you restate, you have to file a fresh 10K. I've seen companies, we go in and try to find a 10K for a year, and there's six 10Ks every year. Basically, they have a 10K, and 2 weeks later, they'll restate the 10K, and two days later, they'll restate. I mean, if you do it, once I can see your accountant was drunk and he couldn't do the 10K, but either you kept this guy on and he keeps doing it year after year, or this has become a pattern. So this is what falls into the area of forensic accounting now. And since 2001, this has become a fairly hot area in investing, is accountants who actually dig for clues. There's going to be a TV show on this. No, actually not. Like CSI, like CFA. No. That would actually be an interesting concept. Forensic accountant to the rescue, right? Accounts payable, I found it now. Right? So, but I don't think that'll happen. So it's forensic accounting is all about collecting. I'll send you a couple of links on readable books. Most of the forensic accounting books are completely unreadable, because they're written by accountants who are so immersed in the footnotes, they think everybody thinks in footnotes. These are actually forensic accounting books that you and I can read and say, hey, you know what, I can take that. No. So I'll send you a couple of links on those, because it is worth looking at if you're valuing a company. Not just in the context of what you're doing in the class, because obviously you're not putting real money yet on your, but if you're going to put real money in a company, then might as well do your homework. Which brings me to the last slide for today, and I'm going to set this up because we'll continue through today. Who's doing the negative earnings company in this class? Come on, at least one-fifth of the class needs to be doing a negative earnings company. Unless you're the one guy in every, are you in every team with the negative? That could be a, you know, free agent for sale, right? Can be the negative earnings guy. But at the end of this process, assuming you looked at your earnings, this should be one out of five people should be doing a negative earnings company. And you have perhaps the most difficult task in your entire group. So if you're looking at the negative earnings company, here's the question you need to start with. Why are my earnings negative? That sounds like a stupid question, right? You're saying, because my expenses exceed my revenues. I know, that's why. But why exactly did that happen? Because you need to diagnose this before you decide what to do. It could be because you had a temporary problem, that Boeing strike, one-time problem. It could be that you're a cyclical company, and you're a really good company, but the economy is in a recession. These are your easy cases, because if it's one-time or cyclical, you can just replace the negative earnings that you see from the trailing 12 months with an average across time, or take out that bad year and you're okay, you're done. You can just value the company as if it were a positive earnings company. Here's your more problematic negative earnings company. You have a negative earnings company because you're valuing Snapchat or because you're valuing Twitter. It's not because you're a bad company, but because of where you are in the life cycle. You could have a negative earnings company because of some structural problems, valuing GM because it's producing SUVs when everybody wants cars. That's not going to get fixed overnight. Or you could have a negative earnings company because you have a company which has too much debt. There, the problem is not going to go away overnight. You can't replace negative with positive earnings. You've got to coax this company back to positive earnings. You say, what are you talking about? Your margin right now might be minus 8%, but you have to figure out what they will look like as a healthy company. You have to map out on your spreadsheet that pathway from money loser to money maker. And you have to hope and pray that along the way, what doesn't happen? What happens to a lot of negative earnings companies? They don't make it, right? They go under. And you say, oh, please God, don't let that happen because my spreadsheet looks so good. So we'll talk about what to do when that please God doesn't come through, because that's going to put down the value of your company. But this is what we'll start with in the next session.
Monday and Wednesday.
Yeah.